So I would like to complete the analysis of the string, superstring theory spectrum. So if you recall, our basic building blocks were the states for the master, the states for the fermions, which could be NS, 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 R, R, NS, and Ramon, Ramon, depending on the periodicity properties of the fermions on the left-moving and right-moving sector. And then we had the Gauss ground states. And this Gauss ground state had a property that had L0 equal to 0 bar equal to minus 1 half. And it had fermion number 1. Furthermore, the Ramon sector, the Spinor indices. These Ramon sectors carry Spinor indices, which could be decomposed into positive and negative chirality. So I could write it like that. And depending on the top on the string theory being type 2A or type 2B, these ones would have a fermion number which, so let's say that for conventions, this one has fermion number 1. Then this state with a fermion number equal to minus 1, just because it's the opposite chirality. And then the question is, what about this? What is the f bar of this state? And this could be plus or minus 1, depending on this being type 2b or type 2a. And correspondingly, then this will be equal to minus plus 1. And our rules for type 2 strings was to impose what's called the GSO projection in order to make sure that all the vertex operators are local and that we're allowed to use all four sectors, in other words, or Ramon. Then we need to impose that minus 1 to the f equal to 1. So in the Neville-Schwarz sector, we found that this forced us to consider to throw away the tachyon. Well, we didn't mind that. Mm-hmm. and to so the first non-trivial state in the universal sector was this massless bunch of states, which are again symmetric with two indices, and we can identify with graviton, B field, and dilaton. Now you might wonder, wait, shouldn't the graviton have del x, del bar x? Right? After all, we know that the graviton was something we could add to the graviton vertex operator was something we could add to the Lagrangian to deform the gravity of the ground. Now, a quick answer to that we'll discuss the correct answer that concern, but perhaps a useful way to think about this is the following. So in the bosonic string, we started with some vertex operator of the form VCC bar, right? And then we went to some integrated form for that. It went into an integral of V, the Z bar, which then is something you can match with, something you could exponentiate and add to the Lagrangian. Now, in the superstring, there is some other stuff involving the super ghosts. Anyway, there is some ghosts mess that is the state operator map, an image of this. But somehow, when you go to the integrated form, you get naturally something like integral of V, the Z bar, the theta bar. So if you want, there are both some moduli, bosonic and some fermionic moduli in your space of Riemann surfaces. There are B's and beta insertions. Anyway, at the end, roughly, this is the supersymmetric version of this. This is the natural way to write terms in a Lagrangian, which would be preserve supersymmetry on the worksheet. So this is reasonable. Now, if you look at how the fields are assembled into superfields, this looks like the usual. So you just give me something more imposing name. This starts with a fermion, and then there is something like that. This is analogous to what we saw for the particle, right? For the particle, we had sort of these superfields, which are like x plus theta psi. And then you took a derivative, a superderivative of that, and you get psi plus theta x dot. Okay, these are sort of natural things to use to do supersymmetric stuff. This is one such natural thing. Okay? And so a vertex operator like this, a state like this, will go in an integrated form to something that is essentially integral of psi mu. Psi bar mu delta g mu nu. The theta bar, the z bar. When you expand this out, see, when you do integrals over theta, remember the Castanet integral peaks powers of theta, which means this Gassmann integral is going to pick the del x, del bar x and produce your graviton, your variation of the graviton, or the metric. So this is not a nonsensical thing to look at. It's pretty reasonable. Okay. Next, we could look at the NSR sector. Now, notice that the choice of sector also affects the superghosts. So I should really specify ground state for a specific sector. Now, this guy here is still going to have L0 equal to minus 1 half, but L0 bar is actually 0. It's perhaps actually worth saying a word about this. See, I mentioned before the stress tensor and the supercurrent. They satisfy an interesting, the modes of this object satisfy an interesting algebra called the super-Virasoro. So schematically, the Virasoro modes give you other Virasoro modes. Virasoro with G modes give G modes. And G with G modes give Virasoro modes, schematically. The details don't really matter. Now, in an NS sector, G will be expanded in half integral modes. But in a Ramon sector, G is expanded in integral modes. And in particular, there is some G0. And G0 squared equals L0. So if you have a state which is annihilated by G0, it's also annihilated by L0. And this is pretty much the reason for which the contribution from the fermions are precisely such that. So I should say properly. So this thing, what I mean is these things together have L0 bar equal to 0. Okay. So this is not the vacuum. It has some energy. This in the Ramon sector, again, is not the vacuum. It has some energy. But this energy exactly cancels the Casimir energy so that the total energy vanishes. Because this combination is cubed by G0, and G0 squared is essentially L0. So as a result, in order to satisfy a Virasoro constraint, we should not add any other. I mean, the simplest thing we have to do is to add no other right-moving oscillators, and set P squared equal to 0. If I do that, though, I need to compensate the left moving minus 1 half. And I'll do so by putting a psi to the minus 1 half mu. So this thing gives you some field which has one spin index, which spin index depends on the choice. I mean, we can look at it, you can figure it out by looking at this table. We want A bar to have fermion number and minus 1 to the F equal to minus 1 to compensate things. So this means that this will be either an A bar or an A dot bar depending on type 2A or type 2B. Okay? But there will be also a vector index. So this is a spin tree half field. It has a vector index and a spinor index. Something like this is called the gravitino. And in the same way as having a massless thin shoe guy guarantees that you're talking about gravity, about Einstein gravity pretty much, plus correction, the very existence of these guys implies that you're talking about supergravity, a theory of gravity which has local supersymmetry in space-time. So because we found these massless guys, we automatically discovered that this theory has space-time supersymmetry. There's nothing to do with the supersymmetry we put on the worksheet. It's an extra bonus that comes along. And it is extremely useful because supersymmetric theories are very constrained. For example, writing down the effective action for the whole superstring for these massless modes just requires you to open some textbook and write down the only supergravity action which has that much supersymmetry. So now we found the gravitino here. In the Ramon, in the RNS sector, you find another gravitino just by the same. So the main difference between type 2A and type 2B is that gravitinos in type 2B have the same chirality, and in type 2A they have opposite chirality. Altogether, this gives you a system which has 32 supercharges, 32 supersymmetries in space-time, because these spinors have 16 components each. And it turns out that actually 32 supersymmetries is the maximum possible number you can have in a theory which includes gravity. So superstring theory gives you something that is as supersymmetric as possible. If you were to have more supersymmetry than that, the theory would be free and have higher spin degrees of freedom, massless higher spin fields. OK. And now we come to the most interesting sector, perhaps. To a very interesting sector, which is the Ramon-Ramon sector. So in the Ramon-Ramon sector, these guys have already a 0 equal to 0 bar equal to 0. So we don't need to add anything here, we just set p0, p squared equal to 0. So this guy gives a bunch of fields with two spinor indices. And we'll spend a bit of time now unpacking what this means. But first I would like to discuss equations of motion. Meaning, here there was some shell condition, right? P squared equal to 0. And then there are also some gauge symmetries, because you can write some states which are Q of something else. Here, we need to impose, so this state is killed automatically by all positive modes of L and all positive modes of G, pretty much. So we don't need to work harder. Once it's killed by L0, we are done. Here, the condition that the state is killed by G0 is slightly stronger than the condition it's killed by L0. It implies it, but it's stronger. So we don't just get p squared equal to 0. We get that if I call my, let's say this, we call my polarization okay, then the condition G0 kills it, G0 involves a psi0, 0 bar, has a term that looks like psi0 bar, A0 bar. So when it acts here, the psi0 bar acts as a gamma matrix. And then A0 bar acts as P. So roughly, these states are killed by P mu gamma mu. So the equations of motion, so the equation of motions here are roughly that, you know, Laplacian equal to zero in space-time. Roughly. Here there's something like del dagger equal to zero, del slash equal to zero. This makes sense. They are spinners, so they should satisfy first order Dirac equations. And they come from G0 bar. In the Ramon sector, now I have condition from G0 bar and from G0. So the equation of motion, so these guys look very weird. There is, it's like they satisfy, they are killed by the Dirac operator acting on either of the two indices. So P mu gamma mu AB equal to zero. I'll just write it like this. And it was supposed to be a bar. Can you read this? So this looks really mysterious. What kind of bosonic field satisfies two first order differential equations? Well, let me give you an example in four dimensions. Let's look at the theory of a photon. If you remember Maxwell equations, they are first order differential equations. We usually write them in terms of a potential, but we don't have to. So Maxwell equations can be written in terms of something like del mu f mu nu equal to zero and del sigma f mu nu epsilon sigma mu nu rho equal to zero. So there are two sets of first order differential equations. More than that, you can, so you can ask in four dimensions, what would be a field that has two spinor indices? Let's say, that I suppose I have a spinor, a field that has two chiral spinor indices. Now, in four dimensions, complex conjugation exchanges the two chiralities, so I should probably include also a complex conjugate. So this has three components. Suppose it's symmetric. So this is a 2x2 matrix, symmetric, has three components. These are the three components. Together they make six components. I claim that this is the same amount of information as an f mu nu. And more precisely, if you take gamma matrices in four dimensions, I will discuss it in a moment, but more precisely, this space, I claim, has the same amount of information as a self-dual field strength, something with the form f mu nu plus epsilon mu nu rho sigma, or with an I, f rho sigma. And this is the same amount of information as the other half I also claim that these maxwell equations, when you write them in terms of the self-dual and not the self-dual parts, and using spinor indices, become precisely del bar alpha beta f beta gamma equal to 0, and del bar, oh sorry, alpha dot beta, and alpha beta dot f beta log gamma equal to 0. So you take Maxwell equations and you repackage the fields in bispinors, in fields which are two spinor indices, then the Maxwell equations become Dirac equations in the two, acting on the two indices. So going back here, you can see that these are going to be some analog of Maxwell, equations. And these Ramon fields are going to be analogs of gauge fields. Now, a bit of representation theory of the Lorentz group helps with this. So let me make some statements which are true pretty much in any dimension. Suppose you have a bunch of common matrices. Okay. Then, because of this, if I had a product of two gamma matrices, it's natural, you know, the symmetric part is pretty trivial. So I can always anti-symmetrize it to get something interesting. Let me just define things like this. You keep anti-symmetrizing indices. So you can, you look at this collection of matrices. D choose 2, D choose 3, all the way to D choose D. If I add this up, I get 2 to the D. On the other hand, which is 2 to the D over 2 times 2 to the D over 2. Suppose that the number of dimension is even, okay? Simplicity. So this is as many as possible matrices with two spinor indices. So these matrices actually give you a basis of objects of the form and maybe objects with two spinor indices. You can decompose an object into this basis, I'll put it like this, simply by taking your MAB and taking traces over spinors of M gamma mu 1 to mu n. This gives you some M mu 1 to mu n, which is totally anti-symmetric. So if you have an object with two spinor indices, you can convert it into a collection of objects with any number of anti-symmetric indices, Lorentz indices, vector indices. Now, if you now try to decompose this statement into bichirality, you can find statements concerning M, AB, MAB dot, and so on. So various pieces of this decomposition have two chiral indices, or one chiral and one antichiral, one antichiral and one antichiral, and so on. For example, one, you know, you can think about this delta AB. and delta A dot B dot. This big product of gamma matrices is a chirality. It's going to be delta AB minus delta A dot B dot. And so on and so forth. This guy has one, you know, the gamma matrix maps one chirality into the other chirality. So it will have indices of opposite side type. And so on and so forth. So roughly, one every two has two indices of some chirality. The other half have indices of the opposite chirality. And plus, there are self-duality conditions. For example, the self-dual part of this, so that this is which is the sum of this and this, will be delta AB without a dot B dot. So that means that we can convert, we can write the Ramon field as some collection of forms. What appears is slightly different in type 2a and type 2b. So in type 2a, there is an f without indices, an f mu nu rho sigma. And then there are things with, say, six indices that are dual to the, which can be contracted with an epsilon tensor to give you the one with four indices and so on. So let's just stop here. In type 2b, there is an f mu nu rho, and an f mu nu rho sigma tau, which is actually self-dual. So these are the Ramon-Ramon fields in the type, in the two string theories. So in type 2a, so this guy is actually silly. It's constant. It has no degrees of freedom. Something called the Roman. It's actually, turns out, has to be an integer. Something called the Roman mass, typically set to zero. We don't know very much how to deal with non-zero. This one describes a gauge field. This one describes some sort of a generalization of a gauge field, which has three indices. It can couple to things, to membranes of some sort. This one is can be thought of as the gradient of a scalar field. It's called the axion, and it combines naturally with the dilaton into a complex field. Then again, this one comes from some true form, an analog of B. And this one, because it's self-dual, is really tricky to express in a second-order formalism. It makes writing down the axion for type 2B not quite simple. It makes sense. It's a perfectly sensible object, but it can create some headaches. Anyway, so these are the fields of type 2a and type 2b. And there is a complicated effective action, which is fixed by supersymmetry. Now, one funny thing is that although these are gauge fields, in the perturbative string spectrum, you do not see any states charged under these fields, which seems bothersome. What's the point of having gauge fields if you don't have anything charged under them?
Why does it happen?
It's just that if you suppose you try to have something like this, which have a some particle, you know, emitting one of these Ramons, pretty much because these are so emitting a Ramon can only transform a Ramon state into an S state. So this could only be coupled to symmetries, which should mix up Ramon state, Ramon, and Everschwartz. And there are no such symmetries. You know, you cannot mix the graviton with the. That's a very basic statement. And then again, also, as I said, the action is fixed by supersymmetry. You can just write the action, and it has no direct couplings. You know, there are couplings involving the field strength, but there is nothing like an integral of a mu along the trajectory. You know, this is not entering any covariant derivative, say. Nicely enough, when you look at D-brains, you find that D-brains are charged under this. So I'm gonna discuss D-brains for these theories momentarily, but it so happens that, for example, type 2A has a D0 brain, which is a particle coupled to this mu, has a D2 brain, which is a membrane coupled to this. Type 2B has a string coupled to a D1 brain, which is an extra string coupled to this, and so on and so forth. A D3 brain coupled to this. So you can think about Ramon fields as fields which are sourced by the D-brains. Now, do you have any more questions about the derivation of the spectrum? Now, these are not the only superstring theories that you can define. There is a third possibility. So we define bosonic strings. We define type 2, a mesh on type 0. But type 0 has a tachyon, so it's not interesting. But there is something else interesting that you can do, which is very counterintuitive, which is called an heterotic string. An heterotic string essentially takes half of the superstring and half of the bosonic string and combines them together. Essentially, the point is there is nothing that forces the two-dimensional conformal field theory to have exactly the same degrees of freedom moving to the left and moving to the right. So in heterotic string, you say, okay, I take my scalar fields, I take my fermions, left moving fermions. I do not take right moving fermions. I do things which are supersymmetric on the holomorphic side, but not on the anti-holomorphic side. I don't put any theta bars. I have my stress tensor and the supercurrent, but I don't have an anti-Chiral supercurrent. Okay. Correspondingly, I have my ghosts and superghosts, holomorphic. I have my anti-holomorphic ghosts, but no anti-holomorphic superghosts. This creates a mismatch in the central charge. In the left moving, right moving central charges are not the same if I just keep these degrees of freedom.
Wouldn't it break some of the symmetries?
Well, Lorentz symmetry is still fine. And I'm gonna have sort of a heterotic super diffeomorphism group, which somehow manages to do with half of the fermionic degrees of freedom. I mean, you can write a supergravity, which in two dimension, which has half as many gravitinos as we did in type two, as possible. And then you gauge fix it, and you can land on something like this. The mismatch between left moving and right moving degrees of freedom is not good. It's not, I mean, it can create trouble. There are potential gravitational anomalies, unless the mismatch is precisely, has a very precise value. Has to, you know, the difference in the central charges has to be a multiple of 8, I think. So there is an obvious mismatch in the sense that superstring wanted 10 directions, right? And bosonic string wanted 26. That's a bit of mismatch, right? There are 16 directions which are missing on the anthropomorphic side. The way you deal with this is replace the 16 direction by something else, which can be purely anthropomorphic. For example, you can have 32 anti-chiral fermions. This makes all the central charges work out. And it works, actually. Not trivial. There are a lot of anomalies that can go wrong, but they don't. You need to do your GSO projection properly. There are some important points on how you do the GSO projection here. There are two slightly different ways to do it. So there are two different heterotic strings. If you look at the fields of this heterotic string, the Nevel-Schwartz sector pretty much works as before, except that now you can also try to use these guys to do things. For example, so you can have your psi minus 1/2 mu del bar x nu which gives you your graviton, dilaton, and B field. Those are always there. But now you can also do something like psi mu minus 1/2, lambda bar A minus 1/2, lambda bar B minus 1/2. So you get something which has one space-time index and some extra internal indices. So they're gauge fields. And depending on the two different choices that you can make, this could be SO3, the gauge group for these gauge fields could be SO32 or E8 times E8. SO32 is the easiest to understand. You just have 32 guys, so these indices go from 1 to 32, and then it's anti-symmetric. So if you treat your 32 fermions the same way, you get SO32. Then there is a modified GSO projection where you throw away some of these guys and you put in some Ramon sectors for these guys. So this reduces SO32 to SO16 times SO16, but then adds extra stuff from the Ramon sectors, which complete it to E8 times E8. Now, yes, if you look at the Ramon sector, you end up with just one copy of the gravitinos. And with some super partners, some fermions, some gauginos, some fermions that are super partners of the gauge fields. They come with a very specific chirality. I don't remember if it is an A or an A dot. Doesn't matter. Now, whenever the spectrum of your theory is chiral, which happens here in heterotic string, any type should be, you can have anomalies in space-time. They manifest in some interesting way in the string theory calculations. But anyway, historically, it was a big deal when people computed the anomalies for heterotic string. There were some huge amount of contributions to a pack together involving the gravitinos and this gauginos. It was a hugely complicated calculation that just in space-time had nothing to do with string Turing. And the fact that the anomalies canceled out convinced people that these theories could actually make sense, because it looked like a complete miracle. You know, why a SO 32 and not a SO 31? These are the only two groups which canceled the anomalies in space-time. And it was quite nice that they were produced by the string theory construction. Of course, ultimately, the way it works is that these anomalies were, when you do string theory calculations, are converted in some BRST anomalies, some Q square not vanishing, and so as long as the things are done properly, your Q square vanishes. Things are bound to work out.
These are gravitational anomalies?
Yeah, there were gravitational anomalies, mixed gauge and gravitational anomalies of all sorts. Anomalies are captured by something called anomaly polynomials, which are some big polynomial in the curvatures. The higher you go in dimension, the bigger, the more complicated the polynomial can be. For example, anomalies in two dimensions can be written as a polynomial which is quadratic in the curvature. Mm-hmm. Anomalies in four can be written as a polynomial which is cubic in the curvature, and so on. These were degree six polynomials in the curvatures, whose coefficients had to all separately cancel out. Okay, so this gives you a heterotic string, and here there is type 2b and type 2a. Before deep brains, a heterotic string was considered more interesting because it had gauge fields. You know, you could be ambitious and try to make grand unified models playing around with these E8s. But then, of course, when people understood that deep brains exist, they had a ready way to make gauge fields, interesting gauge fields, in non-abelian gauge fields in type 2 as well. And then people discovered dualities, which tell you that this and that are not actually as different as they look. Meaning that it's perfectly possible to take type 2, make part of space-time into a compact manifold, make it small, and out pops out a different compact manifold for a heterotic string. I'm going to discuss these sort of things momentarily. Now, perhaps I can discuss a little bit the D-brains in type 2. So if you remember, when we're defining deep brains, we pick some boundary conditions for the bosonic, for the scalars. Right. More or less with objective of setting the T parallel perpendicular to zero, which roughly means T equal to T bar. these boundary conditions can be also written as sort of del x equals del bar x, or del x equal to minus del bar x, roughly. Depending on the precise translation depends on what's this slope of your boundary, but intuitively that's how these boundary conditions ensure something like that. Then in superstring, we would have similar conditions involving the supercurrent, which, if you remember, had something like this. So when you do these sort of things for the bosons, you will have to do similar things for the fermions. Okay. And this allows you to define boundary conditions which are reasonable and sensible. Now you can ask two questions. One question is, what sort of boundary states are created by these membranes? And the other is, which spectrum of open strings do I get from these membranes? Right. So here, to read out this answer, you take your cylinder, you look at all four sectors, NSNS, NSR, RNS, RR, and you ask, which state satisfies these conditions? Everything goes pretty much as in the bosonic strain. The only interesting subtlety is that in the Ramon-Ramon sector, you get among all conditions, you get one involving the zero mode. So there is something like gamma, psi 0 equal plus minus psi 0 bar. So this is a non-trivial, these are gamma matrices acting on these by spinors. So these are non-trivial constraints, linear constraints, that kill some of them. And the result is that each D-brain sources the Ramon fields appropriate for its dimension. So if you put a D0 brain in there, in type 2A, it will source this. In type 2B, it will source nothing. Then you turn it around, you ask what are the open strings that live on this D0 brain. And you find in type 2B there is a tachyon. In type 2A there is no tachyon. This kind of makes sense because in type 2B the D0 brain was not charged under anything, so it could decay. So it's reasonable it has a tachyon. In type 2A it's charged under this. A charged particle cannot just disappear in thin air, so there better be no tachyon. See, a tachyon on the D-brain is not a tragedy, it just means that the D-brain is unstable, not that the theory is unstable. And so each of these string theories has a bunch of stable D-brains which are charged under the Ramon-Ramon fields. Furthermore, these D-brains, these stable D-brains, preserve half of the supersymmetries of the bulk space-time. They preserve 16 supersymmetries. This is, one hand, is very useful because it means that it allows one to connect, to constrain very strongly the properties of these D-brains, even non-perturbatively. For example, if you have enough supersymmetry, you can show that supersymmetric objects have a mass which is controlled just by their charge. Say the mass equal the charge over G string. That's cool because the charge is conserved and it's just an integer. It's not going to change as a function of the coupling. And so you discover that the mass of these D-brains is also very controllable. You know exactly what the mass of these D-brains is going to be, no matter what the value of the coupling is, even when you go very far from the perturbative scenario. I'll discuss some of the consequences momentarily. Another consequence is, of course, that the volume theory on the D-brains, the fields that live on the D-brains are very, have an action which is also very constrained by supersymmetry. And actually, it turns out 16 is the maximum amount of supersymmetries that a quantum field theory without graviton can have. So the theories that live on the D-brains are some very special, very supersymmetric quantum field theories. For example, on D3 brains in type 2B, you get anyhow 4 superior mirrors, which is a very special four-dimensional gauge theory. Now, some of the consequences of this non-renormalization theorem, this fact that some properties of these D-brains are fixed by supersymmetry, is that you can make some pretty fun speculations about what happens to superstring theories at strong coupling. For example, type 2A has the zero brains. Whose mass is roughly 1 over the string. And it turns out that there are actually bound states of n the zero brains whose mass is n over the string. These D-brains are particles, they have interesting quantum numbers, just because, so the volume theory of these zero brains has a bunch of fields. Some fields describe their motion in space-time. And then there are some supersymmetric partners of those, which are a bunch of fermions that live on the zero brain. And if you remember, if you have a word line, the theory, you know, a particle whose word line supports some fermionic degrees of freedom, you can get interesting stuff. Right? We were doing it a couple of days ago. So these zero brains have sort of have all sorts of interesting quantum numbers. And then Witten observed that the quantum numbers of these zero brains just look like Kaluza-Klein modes of a graviton in 11 dimensions. So if you make the string coupling larger and larger, these zero brains become lighter and lighter, and they assemble together to describe gravity, supergravity. In 11 dimensions. So this led to the conclusion that there should be an 11-dimensional theory called M theory. Which at low energy behaves like supergravity. And if you put it on R10 times a circle of some radius string will be the same as type 2A. But G-string times some Planck length. G-string units of Planck length. So this was one big and important duality. This is a very non-perturbative statement. We can only make it because we can talk about the zero D-brains. In type 2B, there are D1 brains, which behave as strings, which are strings, just very high tension. The tension of these D1 brains is equal to the tension of the fundamental string over the string. Again, that means if you try to make your string coupling very, very large, these D1 strings are becoming lighter than the fundamental strings and have the same properties. The volume theory of this is exactly the same as the one of the fundamental strings. These and a lot of other pieces of evidence convince people that in type 2B, making the string coupling very strong will bring you back to type 2B, to a dual type 2B with a light, with a small string coupling. So the D1 branch will replace the fundamental strings as the elementary degrees of freedom, and they will be weakly coupled. There is actually a whole bigger duality groups which involve the axion too, because you can make bound states of D1 branches and fundamental strings, which each of which can become light in some strong coupling region. So if you explore the space of couplings, these are the things that you find in flat space. Then you can try to compactify parts of space-time. You get a bigger space of couplings, which include the size of space-time. And you can explore these bigger spaces of couplings. As long as you keep enough supersymmetry as you do it, you can have control on a lot of things and figure out what's going to happen. And this led to people to derive a very long list of dualities, which connect all of these superstring theories with each other or with M theory. So all of these different objects seem to be part of the same theory. Now, as I said, supersymmetry plays a very important role in making these statements. For example, supersymmetry prevents the dilaton from getting a potential. That means that it's self-consistent to talk about perturbative string theory, because the value of the dilaton controls the coupling. If there is no potential for the dilaton, it means that you can actually talk about the behavior of string theory when the dilaton is very small. As soon as you take away supersymmetry, right, the dilaton will want to, will have a potential, will go somewhere, which might be very far from the place where you can have perturbative control. This is why it's very hard to make any statements about non-supersymmetric backgrounds for string theory. It's not that they don't exist, it's just that we don't know how to control them. So the less supersymmetry you want to have at low energy, the harder it is to figure out what string theory is going to do.
Just to clarify, so would the heterotic strings have less supersymmetry than the type 2?
Yes, okay. Half as much, yeah. But it's still enough to control the behavior of the dilaton. Pretty much, when you go, until you go down to 4 supercharges, you're safe. When you hit 4 supercharges, it's you start having some potentials, although they are manageable to some amount. There are no renormalization theorems about these potentials, but they typically tell you things like this potential cannot be created perturbatively, but it can be created non-perturbatively. This poses some very strong constraints on which superpotentials can appear, but it's, you know, they are still there. That's why there has been a lot of effort in building models of string theory where the low energy theory would have 4 supercharges, which is the minimum amount available in 4 dimensions. It's not that that's a prediction of string theory, it's just that the only place where you can do any calculations that you can marginally believe. And now, there were, of course, some phenomenological reasons for which low energy supersymmetry was attractive. Now, the LHC has been putting some pretty strong constraints on those ideas to be charitable. But as I say, it's the lamppost effect, it's not an intrinsic property. The dynamics of string theory are presumably very complicated. they must be more complicated than ones of quantum field theory. And quantum field theory already has very complicated dynamics. So if you completely remove supersymmetry, it becomes very hard to understand what can happen. This also makes it very hard, as I was mentioning at the beginning of the lectures, to make any statements about supersymmetry in cosmology, for example. You know, a theory of quantum gravity, you would hope, could tell you something about cosmology, about the creation of the universe. But we don't have the tools that allow us to discuss these problems. So there are difficulties both at the perturbative and the non-perturbative level. At the perturbative level, a string moving in a complicated space-time requires us to understand a complicated two-dimensional quantum field theory for that describes the motion of the string. This is already hard. And on top of that, you also need to figure out why should you trust any perturbative calculations if your dilaton is free to go somewhere else. Of course, the lack of a non-perturbative definition, it's problematic. Okay, so let me see. I think I gave you most of the basic information about these superstring theories. They're supersymmetric. They fit into complicated dualities. They have interesting deep brains. Do you have any questions? Any more questions?
So, what do you suppose is the string theory manifestation of holography? The expectation that that's one non-perturbative definition of string theory, but in terms of strings, what's going on?
Right, so, yeah, it's a pity I didn't get any chance to discuss it this year.
Can you maybe repeat the question?
What is the relation between holography and string theory?
Oh.
So we learn how to introduce string deep brains in perturbation theory, and we learn how to introduce one deep brain. So the fact that the tension of these deep brains or mass of these deep brains goes like 1/g string is actually quite fun, because it's precisely in between sort of an object of tension of mass 1/g string squared. Would back react heavily on the background. An object of mass 1 would be light and move around easily, and you wouldn't be able to treat it as an heavy thing sitting there, all the body in perturbation theory. But deep brains sit exactly in between. On one hand, they're very heavy, if you bounce a string out of them, they just get deflected at 1/g string. So in perturbation theory, you can think about them as static. But on the other hand, they back react a little. So they source a gravitational field of 1/g string. Now, if you put a lot of d-brains, though, you can get a back reaction. If you put n d-brains, where g-string n is of 1/g, you can get a back reaction. What's going on is that, so you can think about this back reaction too. So these deep brains will become some back reacted object, essentially a black hole in gravity. And now you have sort of these dual perspectives. On one side, you think that you should be able to just think about closed strings moving in the background of this black hole. On the other hand, the definition of this black hole in terms of n deep brains says, wait, no, you should do closed strings moving in flat space with 1/n² open strings added in this neighborhood, you know, with the volume theory of the d-brain added in. For this two perspective to be compatible, it must be that the volume theory of the Lebrains is able to mimic the neighborhood of the black hole. And this is called open-closed duality. Now, it's possible to take a scaling limit which gets rid of the rest of space-time and just focuses near the black hole. This is what Malacena did. And as a result, you get a statement that just the volume theory of the Lebrains, which was something like n equal 4 super mu, some gauge theory, UN gauge group and large N, must be dual, must reproduce completely the behavior of closed strings, and gravity in particular, in the neighborhood of the black hole, which is something called anti-de Sitter space. And so you get to holography, that gravity or string theory in anti-de Sitter space must be equal to a quantum field theory. Now you can turn this around and say, okay, wait, then this means that if I just know how to solve this quantum field theory, I have defined fully string theory in that anti de Sitter background, which is true. So that quantum field theory gives you an unperturbative definition of string theory in that anti de Sitter background. That anti de Sitter background is kind of like a box. It's really gravity in a box. There is a boundary from which gravitons bounce off. And the way this duality works is that somehow the correlation functions of quantum field theory answer questions like, what if I poke this box, the boundary of this box here and here, and I check what hits the boundary of the box there and there? So the whole content of the box is mapped into what hits the boundary. You know, it's a bit like thinking about scattering matrices in space-time, right? You compute a scattering matrix, you probe a theory by sending things in and seeing what comes out. But anyway, so this is true. So this is a non-perturbative definition of string theory in that box. Now there are a whole bunch of Lebrains, and each gives you a different quantum field theory. And that quantum field theory gives you a non-perturbative definition of string theory in a different box. So that means that the non-perturbative definition of string theory depends on the global structure of space-time. You don't have that's very peculiar. So if you decide that holography is the way to give a non-perturbative definition of string theory, you need to face the idea that different global structures of space-time will give you completely different non-perturbative definitions. So you're losing again the idea that there is a unique string theory, right? It's locally in this box, any experiment that is local will find the same string theory, but still because the box is different, the non-perturbative definition is different. And in particular, this means that you have not learned much about a non-perturbative definition of string theory in flat space or in a cosmological background, because these are different boxes. So I don't know if there is a box-independent non-perturbative definition of string theory. I really have no idea. But I find the situation confusing. Any more questions? I mean, I would like to stress that the quantum field theories that appear when you look at different boxes are really completely different. There is quantum field theory called n equal 4 super mu, which describes this five-dimensional anti-de Sitter box. There is something else called ABGAM, which describes a four-dimensional box. ABGAM is like a Simons theory with UN times UN gauge group, whatever, and complicated matter, which doesn't seem to have anything to do with the four-dimensional gauge theory, and equal four super mu, except that they have a lot of supersymmetry. But okay, then I guess we're done. Thank you for staying with me for these 3 weeks.